Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome. Well, coming up first today, we've heard a lot about the health benefits of the Mediterranean diet over the years, and today we'll be taking a look at the latest scientific findings around this, and in particular, the evidence for chronic disease management and weight control. I'll introduce my guest experts in just a moment. I'll also share an interview with you that I did with senior editor of Esquire magazine, Ross McCammon. We talked last week. He describes the workplace as a landscape of fear and ego, and he'll share career tips with humor and poke holes in traditional success rules. His new book is called Works Well with Others. And we'll end today's show with a look at how families of veterans are wounded by our wars. Stacey Bannerman's husband served in Iraq 2 tours. She's an extremely active advocate with a powerful message. She's been on all the really large media talk shows discussing this subject. And today she'll share some of the challenges that caregivers and veterans face, as well as resources that many veterans and their families may not be aware of. But first, we are talking with Dr. John J.B. Anderson and Marilyn Sparling about their new book, which is called The Mediterranean Way of Eating, Evidence for Chronic Disease Prevention and Weight Management. Let me just tell you a little about each of them. Dr. Anderson has been on the faculty of the Department of Nutrition in the Gilling School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina since 1972. He has a doctorate in physical biology, and his research career has centered on the linkages among nutrients, hormones, lifestyle factors, and bone health. He's published several books and written around 150 scientific articles. He currently sits on the editorial boards of several journals, including the British Journal of Nutrition, Journal of Bone and Mineral Research, Osteoporosis International, and Nutrition Research. Very busy there. Marilyn Sparling is a registered and licensed dietitian, recently retired from Duke University Medical Center, where she was a clinical dietitian in the outpatient endocrinology division. She's a longtime professional member of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics and the American Diabetes Association, and she's also co-authored several journal articles on nutrition and health. I want to welcome you both, Dr. Anderson and Marilyn Sparling. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you here because this is a you know, I love Mediterranean food, and so this is a great subject for us today to look a little deeper into. We've covered it several times, as I mentioned to you before we started. We've talked about it several times on the show, but you have a new book out that is presenting the latest and greatest science, and I think it's important for us to keep up with that. And the latest and greatest is actually good news. So we'll be looking at that very shortly. But first of all, I want to ask you just to share a little bit about your book. And full disclosure to listeners, because they know that I always read the books that we talk about on air. And I did not, unfortunately, receive your book in time, so I haven't seen it. But I know based on your experience and the work that you're doing that your research is spot on there. So tell us, you know, if I go to the bookstore, there's probably, I don't know, 50 books there about the Mediterranean diet. What makes your book different? Why should I pick your book up?
Our book emphasizes research findings. We have many references, although it's not so heavily referenced within the text itself. But we cover the more recent literature over the last 20 years that explain potential mechanisms through which the Mediterranean type of diet has benefits on health. And two of the major ones that we cover in our book are cardiovascular disease and diabetes. And these two, plus many other conditions or diseases, have been shown by a number of reports. This is really quite a large literature survey, show that many of the diseases are that people with the diseases benefit from a Mediterranean diet, which is something that Marilyn should say a little bit more about.
Yes, please, Marilyn, jump in here.
Okay, I think what's really special about this book is it's very comprehensive. As John said, it covers the scientific aspect for those who really want to look at the studies and see where the evidence is. But then the other good part of the book is filled with specific practical suggestions on how to follow this way of eating. So you have your chapters on each of the different kinds of foods and food groups. And within that, there's all kinds of suggestions on what to look for when you're shopping, what to do when you eat out, how do you adopt this kind of way of eating into your own lifestyle. And it's a well-balanced of the macronutrients, carbohydrates, protein, and fats. It's not low-carb, high-carb, or low-fat, high-fat. It's a balanced way of eating, and it's more the quality of those three macronutrients that's important, and the quantity. And there's very detailed information, for instance, in the chapter on grains. What's a whole grain? You know, what are the different kinds? What does processed mean? Many questions and things that people ask are covered in these very practical chapters.
Right. So we don't have a great deal of time here, and I want to look specifically at a Spanish study that was done recently. Breast cancer is a leading cause of female cancer, as we know. Yes. Its incidence has increased by more than 20%, I read in your material, worldwide since 2008. That's a lot. Either we're getting better at finding it or it's increased, but either way, it's more prevalent than it was. And the Spanish study shows the benefit of the Mediterranean diet in lowering that risk. But tell us more about that.
Yes, I think you're referring to the Pretty Med study that came out of Spain. And that study examined the various components of the diet that's consumed in Spain. And the Mediterranean diet in Spain is a little bit different from the one in France, the one in Italy, and the one in Greece, and in the Mediterranean countries of eastern part of the sea. But basically, the fats were more of the monounsaturated fats and the polyunsaturated fats. And it's partly because olive oil is recommended, especially virgin or extra virgin olive oil is recommended on a daily basis and consumed that way in Spain. In addition, a fair amount of fish is consumed. And fish also have, especially the deeper sea fish, tend to have a beneficial fatty acid platform, so to speak, that is more of the polyunsaturated fats and so on. So there are a lot of things, and I haven't mentioned anything about the fruits and vegetables and legumes, which are quite heavily used by the Spanish people that were in this study. I believe that nuts and seeds were also another component, and perhaps there were others.
Right.
But they're basically components that are consumed on a fairly regular basis in these countries. And they have improved, they think, the rates for breast cancer because of the components in the various foods, and especially olive oil, for example. Not only has a better fat profile, but it also has a lot of plant molecules or phytochemicals that have benefits. And
right.
That's rather unique for that particular olive oil. Other oils don't have that typically.
Right. So I think that we kind of, I think of, when I think Mediterranean diet, of that olive oil. You also mentioned, and we only have 2 minutes left, I'm afraid here, but you also mentioned that it's particularly good for cardiovascular and diabetes. Let's talk about diabetes, because we haven't really addressed that before.
Sure. Marilyn.
Yes, and we're talking particularly about type 2 diabetes in here, because that's what is so devastating problem today in many countries, not just the U.S., and there's some relationship to obesity with type 2 diabetes. And again, there's a lot of diets that come out for these, but they're a diet, meaning that it's something you go on and then go off later, and you're only doing it for weight. You're not looking at overall health. And what's so good about the Mediterranean diet is that in terms of carbohydrate consumption, if you're eating carbohydrates that are whole grains, things that have more fiber, more plant foods, less meat, you don't eliminate anything on the Mediterranean way of eating. You may, you know, have less of some things and bigger, you know, not as often, but it's a very flexible dietary plan. But it's the fiber that helps a lot in the glucose control and to managing glucose.
I see. You know, and I know the third part of the book, which you briefly mentioned, but I'll just reiterate here because you mentioned that you study a lot of the science behind it and that. But the third part of the book focuses specifically on how to move toward that Mediterranean-style diet in our own lives and tips for eating at home, dining out, and strategies for implementing those changes, which I think many of us need help with. Well, the book is called The Mediterranean Way of Eating, Evidence for Chronic Disease Prevention and Weight Management. My guests here, very pleased that you could join us today, Dr. John B. Anderson and Marilyn C. Sparling. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And again, the book, The Mediterranean Way of Eating, Evidence for Chronic Disease Prevention and Weight Management. You can find that out right now. Well, please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be looking, the senior editor at Esquire magazine about his new book and why he calls the workplace an odd landscape where we never really talk about the things that matter. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please do stay tuned.
Little seas can be big seas to the wrong or long of sights, but the Mediterranean looks like aspirin tonight. The doctor told me, the chemist, he had nothing for my plight, but the Mediterranean looks like aspirin tonight.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services, if you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
You listen when your body says, "I'm tired," or "I'm hungry." What if your body said something else might be wrong? Gynecologic cancers, cervical, ovarian, and uterine cancers have symptoms. so pay attention. If your body says something may be wrong, please listen. Learn the symptoms. Get the inside knowledge about gynecologic cancers. A message from HHS and CDC's Inside Knowledge Campaign.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, successfully integrate business and life with branding expert Zane Raj, who tells us how to create brand rituals that create customers for life. Composer and strategic consultant Bob Caporali explains the connections between composing music and composing successful business strategies. And talent manager Carol Vallone Mitchell takes an innovative, sometimes controversial approach to show how women can hone their innate skills and rise to the top. Join us Mondays at noon right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Remember, you're listening to Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
But my chosen drug tonight is the reliable Mediterranean.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, my next guest I actually talked with on Friday. He is Ross McCammon, a senior editor of Esquire magazine and author of Works Well With Others. And because of scheduling conflicts, I talked with him last week. We're going to bring you that recorded conversation today. His book is described as an honest, funny, entertaining journey from imposter to authority, a story that begins with periods of debilitating workplace anxiety, but leads to rich insights and practical advice from a guy who, quote, made it, but who still remembers what it's like to feel entirely ill-equipped for professional success. And he is, as I said, Ross McCammon. He's a senior editor at Esquire magazine, where he's responsible for the magazine's coverage of pop culture, drinking, cars, and etiquette. He has edited Esquire's Dubious Achievement Awards and a long-running annual feature, The Best Bars in America. He writes the monthly feature, The Rules, and is a frequent contributor to the magazine's back page humor section, This Way Out. He's also been, for the past 3 years, he's been the business etiquette columnist at Entrepreneur magazine. And as I said, his new book is called Works Well With Others, An Outsider's Guide to Shaking Hands, Shutting Up, Handling Jerks, and Other Crucial Skills in Business That No One Ever Teaches You. And let me just set up our conversation here. The book begins with McCammon's own story. Here he is now, the senior editor at one of the most prestigious magazines in the world, and yet just 10 years ago, he's sitting in his tiny office. He's working for an in-flight magazine. He's staring out of a second-floor window at a parking lot in suburban Dallas, wondering if it's 5 o'clock yet and where the heck his life is going. And then the next few minutes changed his life.
Well, I got a phone call, kind of a mysterious phone call, and from a you know, a recruiter in New York, a media recruiter in New York, who didn't really tell me why he was calling. He just kind of asked me a lot of questions, and I finally said, "Listen, you know, I got stuff to do. What's this all about?" And he said, "Well, there's this job at Esquire magazine," and my jaw pretty much hit the floor because that was, you know, my favorite magazine, and it wasn't, you know, and moving to New York, you know, was a dream that I really never even, you know, allowed myself to have, and it was just it was a really amazing moment to even, you know, be asked to come up and interview for this job, and, you know, but it's funny that the job wasn't what, you know, sort of freaked me out, although I guess it did a little bit. What you know, I was kind of concerned about was just the mechanics of the whole thing, just even the interview process. You know, it felt like a bigger stage than what I was used to feeling, and I felt like what I think a lot of people feel like sometimes in their career, and that is, you know, maybe a bit of an imposter or an outsider.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the book, you know, is not all memoir, but it certainly, you know, starts off with that story of being, you know, asked to come to New York and interview for, you know, what I consider to be a really, you know, an amazing opportunity.
Well, Well, the book is described as an honest, funny, entertaining journey from imposter to authority. A story that begins with periods of debilitating workplace anxiety. And, you know, I mean, 10 years later, here you are writing a book telling others how to succeed at this stuff. But it's very tongue-in-cheek and very funny. It made me laugh out loud in several places. Why did you decide to write it this way?
Well, first of all, it's the highest compliment you can give me. it's a funny book because, you know, there's a reason why, you know, on the back of the book it says, you know, humor, and then it says, you know, career. I think it's a funny book first. But, and, you know, it's interesting, you know, going from imposter to quote-unquote authority. The great thing about, you know, if you want to be an authority in something, all you have to do is say, I'm an authority. It's like being an expert. It's like, you know, so are you an expert? Yeah, sure, I'm an expert. You know, it says so on my website. But yeah, I mean, I wanted to write a book that I wouldn't have written an earnest book about this stuff. You know, that's just not how I look at business and the workplace. I think the workplace is, you know, it's a really serious place, and I take my job very seriously, and I take my interactions with people very seriously. But I think on some level, it's a really absurd place too. There's a lot of, you know, odd customs, and there's, you know, I think there's just, you know, all these things that we don't really ever talk about, but that we do all of the time. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of humor in those things. And even I think just pointing them out is part of the fun of this book, and hopefully the humor of this book. But there was no way that I was going to write a serious, you know, etiquette guide. I will leave that to other people.
Well, I think, you know, you talk about the workplace being a landscape of fear and ego. And I think what you've done by making this humorous is take that fear out of it and the ego out of it. And certainly, I could definitely relate to much of what you wrote about in here, as I'm sure can many of our listeners. And I want to go back to this imposter syndrome that you've mentioned a couple of times, because I run into people all the time who are changing careers midlife, and they say, I feel like an imposter. So let's talk about that and what kind of advice you give people. You say, this is a hugely important rule. You say this in the book, no matter how famous or important, everyone is just really weird and really nervous, especially the people who don't seem weird or nervous.
Yeah, I think it's a secret to success. I really do. I think that you know, we all have the opportunity in our careers to meet, you know, so-called important people who, you know, seem to have it figured out. When you're in New York and you're kind of in the media world in New York, you see, you know, important people in the form of celebrities, you know, and so you see these people who, you see them sort of up close. And one thing you realize is that they're all a little odd too. They're all a little weird, and they can be kind of nervous and a little skittish and a little weird, and they're just human beings, you know. I think it's how people become successful, is that they have that, you know, they there's something that makes them a little bit uncomfortable. Do you know what I mean? That it just kind of...
Oh, absolutely.
You can use that energy, I think. You can use that feeling of being an outsider to, you know, I don't really like this term, but to get ahead, because it can propel you, you know. It can propel you as long as you acknowledge it. And I think acknowledging that other people feel the same way, I think is really comforting. And
yes.
I think that, you know, I mean, you hear this all the time, especially from actors, and, you know, I mean, one of the people I quote in the book, Sonia Sotomayor, the Supreme Court Justice, you know, she talked about being at Princeton and just felt like she totally did not belong. And,
right.
and you hear people say this a lot. It's an extremely common feeling, and I think that, you know, one of the, you know, if I this book does get into sort of rules and etiquette stuff, and, you know, that it's to really just feel more comfortable in situations where those feelings can kind of get in the way of how you interact with people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
that anxiety can kind of get in the way, it can, you know, of an interview, or how you enter a room, or how you have lunch, you know, how you have an important business lunch. You know, we just need to acknowledge that, you know, everybody feels this way. In fact, you know, the people that you might be aspiring to be like, they also feel this way.
Yes. I used to watch the Actors Work or Actors Studio many years ago with James Lipton, and from Gene Hackman to Robert De Niro and Meryl Streep, they all said they felt like imposters, and they could never, they always called their agent, you know, to say, get me out of this movie, I just can't do it. So you write in the book, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, I think it's interesting, you know, you would think, oh, well, I guess that's just actors who feel that way. But those are just the people who are being asked about it.
Yes.
I think if everybody was up there with James Lipton and they was asking about their career, they probably would say, yeah, I don't know how I got this gig, you know?
That's right. You say that as you met more and more interesting people, you realized that most of the rules of success don't work, i.e. you don't have to sell yourself, you don't have to network. So talk to us about that a little, if you would.
Well, I just think this idea of selling yourself as if you are some sort of piece of merchandise is a very, very bad idea. I think, though, that being able to honestly and authentically and confidently speak about your accomplishments is a wonderful thing. And I think that incidentally, you're selling yourself, I suppose. But this idea that, you know, you need to muster up some narcissism and, you know, deliver this amazing pitch, I just think you come off as off-putting. There's a chapter on passion in the book, and, you know, passion supposedly is this big virtue, you know, in business, and especially, you know, like in the tech world, and you have to evangelize for your thing or whatever. And I just think that it just masks the humanity that you're supposedly exhibiting. And I think it kind of gets in the way from being a human being. You know, I think you just have to moderate. You know, just have to moderate. And the most important thing you can do for yourself is seem human, you know, and not just like, you know, this super worker. But I don't think you need to, quote unquote, sell yourself. And I think networking, you know, God, if I could avoid a quote unquote networking event for the rest of my career, that would be wonderful. But supposedly these are what lead to, you know, important connections. I don't know.
I think that,
you know, you're going to form those relationships if they need to be formed, you know?
Yeah, and I think you make a very good point that ultimately it's the humanity in you that people do connect with. That's what they really connect with.
I hope so.
One of the things you talk about is social situations. You know, so many people are very uncomfortable in formal settings, or, you know, and often today you have to do job interviews, you know, and it's an all-day process and you have to go to lunch with people. A lot of people struggle with small talk. You say you cannot be an interesting conversationalist if you're faking interest in something. So talk to us about curiosity, because you say you believe that's the most underrated virtue of business today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, the problem with small talk is it doesn't seem curious. You know, that you know, if you can replace the person you're speaking with another person randomly and continue that conversation, that's small talk. And that's a problem, because you can't just keep going with small talk. It's a pointless endeavor. I mean, I think what you want to do, and this is a little cute, I have to admit, but I think what you want to do is get to medium talk. I think you want to get out of the small talk zone as quickly as possible. The only way you can do that is to be legitimately curious about things. You know, I don't know if you ever, you know, like when someone says, I think you're hearing me, but you're not listening to me, you know, that curiosity is that way. You know, you can enter a room, you can enter a meeting room, and you can be present, but that's different than being curious about what's going on. And I think that if you just remind yourself that curiosity is an important thing, it can be, you know, on a short elevator ride or in an important meeting, and certainly at an interview, that can really change your interaction. We talk about performing all the time. You know, we got to perform, you know, in a job interview. But really, I think what you need to be is curious. You know, you need to be curious about the job. You need to be curious about the person who is sitting across from you. And I think they'll become curious about you.
Right. You have a chapter in the book on pitching, something else that a lot of people just hate to do. And you're someone who has to pitch all the time. You share a test in the book for determining if you have a good pitch. But talk to us a little bit about pitching and what you think works and doesn't work.
Well, it's funny. And I mean, I could do this test on myself in this interview, I suppose. But are you boring yourself? You know, like, listen to yourself talk. Are you bored? Well, if you are, the other person is. It's not working, you know? I think that that's, you know, you have to remember that. And pitching is all kinds of things. I mean, there are formal pitches, I suppose. You know, for me, I have to, you know, pitch an idea to my boss, you know, pitch a story idea. So that's kind of a formal process, I suppose. But there's all kinds of things. There's these, you know, that we're soliciting, you know, people, and I think, you know, it's the test is, you know, are you intrigued by what you are saying? But I think pitching is easy if you actually believe in what you're talking about. And I think that the problem is when you don't believe. And this really, you know, speaks to a larger point of the book, and that ultimately, you know, authenticity is the most important thing. You know, that's, you know, I talk about, you know, these so-called rules of, you know, etiquette and behavior, et cetera, but that's really just to get past that kind of initial anxiety. You know, I think that what you really need to do is you need to become successful enough and comfortable enough that you reject all the rules that you're able to reject, that you feel like you're able to pick and choose and say, this is what works for me, you know, but I'm not going to do it this way. You know, that's ultimately the goal, and that's a very authentic thing.
Right, right. So I want to definitely talk about this. It's a chapter called Sprezzatura, and forgive me if I butchered that pronunciation there. But
works.
You say it's not just a way to think about style, it's a way to think of work. And you say your work should be wrinkled. So tell me what that looks like. You know, for me as a writer, yeah, I'm wrinkled myself, but how do I get my work that way? What are you talking about?
Well, Sprezzatura was an idea that I was introduced to by the Esquire fashion director when we worked together a little bit early on in my career at Esquire. And we did there was a photo feature. I think it was called Sprezzatura. And if you looked at the models, you know, that each one, there was something slightly askew. You know, there was, you know, a collar, you know, one side of the collar was buttoned and the other one wasn't, or the tie, you know, this one guy had a tie like in his, you know, jacket pocket, and, you know, just everything, or it was a little wrinkled, you know. But I love this idea. It's the Italian sort of, you know, the perfection in imperfection. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a great concept for fashion, but I also thought it was a really interesting concept for work, you know, that it's okay if things are a little bit messy, you know, it's okay if things are a little bit wrinkled. That just adds texture, that things like, and I think sometimes when you feel like an outsider and you feel like an imposter, what you try to do is you try to perfect your work, to compensate, you know, you know, I remember staying till midnight working on a headline, which is a really, really bad way to spend your time, you know? And I think, you just need to let things go. I think all creative people certainly, you know, just at some point need to let things go and let things be and let things be messy. But there's a virtue in the messiness. It's not just that it's okay that it's imperfect. It's that it's better.
Right.
You know, and I think if you look at your career that way, you know, hopefully that can alleviate, you know, some anxiety and some feelings that, you know, you don't quite live up. But you're not supposed to. You're supposed to be yourself. You're supposed to do what you do. And it took me a long time to figure that out. But I really think it's the way. It's the way to succeed in a way that's authentic to you.
I think we'd all have a lot more fun at work if they made your book mandatory reading. How about that one?
Well, I think I'd be a lot better off if it was mandatory reading. So I'm right there with you.
Now, you're also, in addition to being senior editor at Esquire, you're also etiquette editor at, or columnist, excuse me, at, I believe it's Entrepreneur. And one of the things you say in the book there is you have a chapter on, you know, basic office etiquette, and you say, never say, let's grab a coffee. Why not?
Well, I always thought I was curious, you know, let's grab a coffee. So, first of all, grabbing a coffee is, safety-wise, that's really not a good idea. You don't want to grab a hot liquid. Okay, so that's number one. But also, it connotes that, you know, it basically says, I just want to quickly have this meeting. I just want to quickly do this and get in, get out, you know. And let's grab lunch. Let's grab a coffee. Let's grab a drink. And I think, you know, the better thing to do, or at least the better way to, I mean, it's really semantics, but the better way to think about it is let's have a coffee. Let's have lunch. Let's make sure that we're, you know, we're not imposing upon people. You know, we shouldn't be imposing upon people when we ask them to socialize, you know, for even for business purposes, you know, that grabbing does not connote something that's meaningful. And so, you know, I just think it's about, you know, but you know what's so funny about that is I find myself typing in an email, let's grab a coffee or let's grab lunch, and then I have to go back and go, oh yeah, I wrote that column. I have to go, delete, you know, and change it to have. But you know, I think that, you know, it's a really important thing. It's like, I think there's a difference between, you know, writing, you know, THX at the end of an email as opposed to thank you. You know, I mean, words matter. You know, words mean something. They connote things. And I think, you know, it's not the end of the world, certainly, but it definitely sends a different message.
Mm. Well, I think the book is not only fun, but it has some great advice in there. It's called Works Well With Others. And I love the subtitle, An Outsider's Guide to Shaking Hands, Shutting Up, Handling Jerks, and Other Crucial Skills in Business That No One Ever Teaches You. What's the number one thing that you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to leave them with one piece of advice. And I know it's obvious, and I know that people said it a million times. I probably already said it in this interview 5 different times. But it's make eye contact. Actually look at people. You know, actually look at people in business. It's amazing what that does. It's amazing what it does for you. It's transformative. It is transformative to look people in the eyes when you're, you know, crossing them in the hallway. Look people in the eyes when you're talking to them at a, you know, during a meeting. You know, I think it's a simple thing, but I think it means so much, and it suggests so much about how you do business, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, and that is being curious, which I think is the greatest virtue of business.
And that was Ross McCammon. You can find out more about him on Twitter at Ross McCammon. It's spelled RossMCCammon. And his book, again, Works Well With Others, An Outsider's Guide to Shaking Hands, Shutting Up, Handling Jerks, and Other Crucial Skills in Business That No One Ever Teaches You. It's a fun book. Well, coming up next, we've heard from politicians that things are drastically improved. But are we really doing enough for our returning veterans and their families? We'll find out with Stacey Bannerman when we come back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please do stay tuned.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Designing Health, makers of Missing Link, we cover the world of animals. This week, October 18th, it's a Best Sunday with Dr. Nels Rasmussen, and we'll have open phone lines. Dr. Nels can help with emotional, behavioral, or physical problems. He can test for allergies, drug, or supplement compatibility and dosages for you or your animal friends. Call us for a free remote session. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
You listen when your body says, I'm tired, or I'm hungry. Are you listening? Would you listen if your body said, I have pain and pressure in my abdomen, I feel bloated for no good reason, or I get too full too fast? I'm spotting, but I've already gone through menopause. Or I have to go to the bathroom more often and more urgently than usual. These can be signs of a gynecologic cancer. like cervical, ovarian, uterine, vaginal, and vulvar cancers. Symptoms aren't the same for everyone. If your body says something may be wrong, please listen, learn the symptoms, and get the inside knowledge about gynecologic cancers. Call 1-800-CDC-INFO. A message from the Inside Knowledge Campaign and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, successfully integrate business and life with branding expert Zane Raj, who tells us how to create brand rituals that create customers for life. Composer and strategic consultant Bob Caporali explains the connections between composing music and composing successful business strategies. And talent manager Carol Vallone Mitchell takes an innovative, sometimes controversial approach to show how women can hone their innate skills and rise to the top. Join us Mondays at noon right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, Stacey Bannerman is my next guest. She created and directed Homefront 9/11 Military Family Monologues, a performance piece that made history when it was presented at the U.S. Capitol. She's single-handedly spearheaded the passage of two bills and worked with Oregon state senators and national legislation to help military families and caregivers. Stacey's appeared on numerous national media outlets, including CNN, MSNBC, NPR, and The Washington Post. And she's the author of When the War Came Home. She's also the author of this new book called Homefront 9/11, How Families of Veterans Are Wounded by Our Wars. Stacey Bannerman, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon.
And I want to begin this. I just want to read a couple of lines from the introduction of your book, and let's talk about that, because this is something that you're a very powerful advocate for, but you've also been through it and I assume are still going through this yourself. So the introduction to Stacey's book: every morning I flip a coin, heads I stay, tails I go. I'm trying to decide whether or not to leave Lauren, my husband of nearly 15 years, a two-time Iraq war veteran who just completed 6 weeks of treatment for a crystal meth addiction. Tell us about that, if you will.
When you're in a situation in which there are no good choices to be made, it's hard to make any choices at all. I met and married my husband, Lauren Bannerman, in Washington State, actually Spokane, in 2000. And at that point, he wasn't even in the National Guard. He served 16 years and he was out. And he re-upped shortly before our marriage in 2000 and did multiple combat tours in Iraq with the Washington State 81st Brigade, where he was profoundly changed. He came home with an 80% service-connected disability rating, severe combat trauma, PTSD, and traumatic brain injury, and what we know to be true is returning vets of these wars have already got the highest rates of post-combat trauma and TBIs of any veteran population. And with that come a number of issues, including significantly higher rates of drug abuse. And that affects the families horribly. It certainly affected me horribly.
Right. So let's go back to something you just said, that this group of returning vets have the highest rate of PTSD. Do we know why? Is it the way that we're fighting today? Is it the longevity, that they're going on too many tours? I mean, do we know why?
Yes, we absolutely do, and it's all of those things. And I discussed that in Homefront 9/11, and the book is effectively an emergency call to this country from the American home front, which historically has been the whole civilian population. But because the civilian population was never mobilized for these post 9/11 wars, there was no draft, there was no war tax, there was no rationing, there were no war bonds, there was absolutely nothing done to create an American home front. And as a result of that, our service members did repeat lengthy combat tours in war zones in which there were no front lines, with a high number, upwards of 90% of casualties over there were civilian. That is the recipe for post-combat trauma. And what we know, and I discussed this in the book, in the biology of war at home, is that the family members of veterans, when the veteran gets sick, the family members do as well. Mental health issues in our family members of troops and returning veterans, the rates of mental health problems in the family members are virtually identical.
And you're talking
mental health problems in the troops themselves.
And you're talking depression and anxiety in particular.
Depression, anxiety, secondary trauma, and all of the hallmarks of that. I'm talking severely depressed immune systems, higher rates of physical illness. We know that veterans caregivers, if that combat vet has PTSD, veterans caregivers have significantly shorter lifespans than caregivers of civilians or caregivers of veterans without PTSD. So the families and caregivers are also paying for these wars with their lives.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, for many people, and maybe this was true for you, Stacey, when their spouse comes home, a different person comes home, totally different person.
Very much so. The man, my husband came home from war, but I can assure you that he was not the man that I married.
Right.
And there is nothing that can prepare you for that. There is nothing that can prepare you for living with a combat vet with severe PTSD. Not that there is any, you know, training available, frankly. There's no such thing as a boot camp for caregivers of veterans.
Right.
There's no such thing. We bear the burden, and it's only 1/3 of 1% of
right.
the country's population. That's the 1/3 of 1%. That's the those are the veterans caregivers who are bearing the whole country's burden for caring for this generation of wounded warriors. Because just as our service members were a minute portion of the population, and as a result of that, carried, you know, 100% of the burden, so are our military families and veterans caregivers. And when you've got the same people carrying a very heavy load for the nation, those people are going to suffer the consequences, and we're seeing that in our families, in our veterans caregivers.
Yeah. So let's look at some of the very common issues and how they can get help. I know that suicide is still extremely high amongst returning veterans. When you live with someone who is threatening suicide, you're taken psychological hostage. It's an extremely difficult, I've actually been in that situation, not because of PTSD, but it's an extremely right. difficult situation because you're scared of saying or doing the wrong thing. You walk on mm-hmm. eggshells every single day. It's a very stressful situation. Where can people find help if they're in that situation?
Well, I want to say also that military family members' rates of suicide and suicide attempts had gotten so high that by 2010, the Pentagon said that there were too many military family suicides and suicide attempts. There were too many for them to even track.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's not only that our returning veterans' suicide rates are high, it is that the military family members and veterans caregivers' rates of suicide and suicidal ideation are really high as well. And unfortunately for the families, there are far fewer resources available. Thankfully, we do have the Returning Veterans Project, and they're available at returningveterans.org. They're based in Portland, Oregon, but they provide services in Washington State as well as Oregon State. Free services to any and all family members of post 9/11 veterans. So that's a wonderful option. Given Hour may be available to provide some services. But what we know to be true is that the consequences of these wars for the family members, talk therapy in and of itself is not, isn't always sufficient. Trauma is really held in the body as well. And one of the great things with the Returning Veterans Project is their providers provide some somatic services as well, which are really, really critical. Now, last I recall, Washington State Department of Veterans Affairs, at one point, counseling could be made available for the spouse of the veteran, as is the case with the vet centers, but that's all tied to the veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And if the veteran doesn't accept services, then the spouse isn't able to receive them either.
Right.
So I'm hoping that more community organizations are going to develop the cultural competence to really effectively serve our military families and families of veterans. There are so many in the Puget Sound area in need of help and support.
It sounds like it. It sounds like we need that extended family and community to become more aware and more involved there. One of the things I was surprised, well, I guess I wasn't really, but you know, we've heard about the suicides and the increase in violence, but child abuse has dramatically increased over the last few years. What should people do about that if they're aware of it in their family or their extended family?
Well, the same thing that would be done, in the event of any sort of domestic violence or child abuse situation, that's notifying the proper authorities and making reports, supporting the spouse, child, family member in helping them to get safe, to become safe, and to keep them safe. There are some funds available for military families if they're victims of service member violence. Transition assistance funds are available for that family to get away and to restart a new life free from that service-connected violence. Unfortunately, that funding isn't available for the spouses who are often caregivers of veterans. So too many of us stay in a situation in which we have already been the victim
right.
of veteran intimate partner violence. My friend Christy Huddleston stayed, and it cost her life.
Right.
I've introduced legislation, the Christy Huddleston Act, to mandate that the VA also have transition assistance funds available for caregivers of veterans so we don't lose any more of our family members here at home.
Right. Well, you talk about, you share a lot of good stories in the book highlighting what happens to people and how they get through this. You say, just to reiterate here, violence, PTSD is not an excuse for violence. It's not a get out of jail free card. You also want people to know that, when their husbands or their wives travel for business, it's not the same thing. You're not dealing with that. What else do you want them to know about this book? It's a very well written book. What do you want them to take away?
Oh, thank you so much. That's so kind. I appreciate that immensely. And I think, the other thing that I think is really important is, in previous wars, when we had the draft in place, married men and married men with children were exempt from the draft because the nation understood. We knew that it would be too much of a hardship on the family. There were overwhelming concerns about that, and it appears that those concerns were justified. And what we're also seeing is one of the factors contributing to the very high rates of mental health issues in our military veterans and their families is the epidemic of disconnection, the divide between the 99% that wasn't impacted by the wars and the 1% of us that were. And what I can say is this. I hope people are able to pick up the book, Homefront 911, and read that and understand why it's so important for them to reach out to a military family member, a veteran family member in their community. I had I was fortunate enough, I was blessed enough
right,
to have
right.
someone who did that for me, and she very well may have helped save my life.
Well, Stacey Bannerman, thank you so much for being with us. Very powerful stories in this book. I know you have a very powerful message to share with everyone. The book is called Homefront 911, How Families of Veterans Are Wounded by Our Wars. And I believe your website is your name, Stacey Bannerman, right?
StaceyBannerman.com, and
thank
I'm
you.
On Twitter and Facebook as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stacey. Again, Homefront 911, StaceyBannerman.com is where you can find out more information. And I want to thank you for being with us today. Appreciate you spending this hour with us. You can find us at conversationslive.net and Facebook, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And if you have comments or questions, 800-495-7617 is where you can send them. All right, we'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.